everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. What do you need to know in the Commonwealth of Virginia as a law enforcement officer to better strengthen and serve your communities? And this is episode 102. Today, we're going to talk about a case from the Court of Appeals, Virginia Court of Appeals, and it's a case out of Richmond that I think is a great example of how to think through maybe a complicated or thorny Fourth Amendment problem that you have, search and seizure problem that you have. And the facts of the case, I think, are very simple and yet present some really nuanced, unusual Fourth Amendment problems that we kind of have to puzzle through to get to the right answer. And the Court of Appeals in this case, I think, does a great job of going through and analyzing this problem, not only to get to the right answer, but to kind of show us an example of how to think through a Fourth Amendment problem for you as a law enforcement officer when you're faced with a situation where you're kind of just wondering, what exactly, you know, what are the defendant's rights here? What is the extent of my authority? Do I need a warrant? Do I not need a warrant? Is this, you know, what's the situation that, you know, what are the rules in this situation? So let me describe what the situation is that the court faced in this case, that the officer faced in this case, and then let's see if we can figure out a way to analyze it. And it's a way that I think is not just going to apply in this case, but in lots of different cases, kind of a way for you to think about Fourth Amendment problems going forward. And before we start, I want to credit a prosecutor from Virginia Beach, a guy named Jason Kowalski. I recently saw him, and he's done this a few times now, talked about how to think about Fourth Amendment problems. And he has a really careful, thoughtful way, and I think a really useful way of thinking about Fourth Amendment problems that I think this case is a great example of. And so hearing him talk again recently and then reading this case, I thought this is a great opportunity for us to sit down and kind of think about how to think. So what's the problem in this case? Well, this is a case from the city of Richmond where the defendant, Mr. Meredith, the case is called Meredith versus Commonwealth, and it's from January 30th from the Virginia Court of Appeals. And it's an unpublished case, which means it doesn't have controlling authority in Virginia. But nevertheless, I think it's still a great example of how to think about this. So it's a case called Meredith. Mr. Meredith gets shot. He suffers a gunshot wound, and he goes to the hospital for treatment. And as you would expect, when he arrives at the emergency room, they cut his bloody clothing off to give him treatment. And they place his personal effects in an open brown paper bag in his treatment room. Now, this particular night, the emergency room has some police in it, some detectives in it. And one of them is a detective who is there. They've been investigating three homicides and five shootings that night in the city of Richmond. And here's Mr. Meredith, also a victim of a shooting. So the officer here, the detective, speaks to Mr. Meredith and asks him about the shooting. And Mr. Meredith basically won't say anything. The most he will say is he was shot in the city of Richmond, and that's about it. So the officer says, all right, well, that's it for that interview. So he completes the interview, and he's leaving. And as he leaves, a nurse from the hospital gives the detective the brown paper bag containing the Mr. Meredith's bloody clothing. And it's important here, I want to pause and mention, and I think it's very significant, the detective here doesn't ask for the clothes. The nurse just gives them the clothes as he's leaving. So at this point, you know, there's no request from the police or anything like that. The investigation is, you know, it's not necessarily over, but, you know, there's not a whole lot. At this point, we don't think Mr. Meredith is the suspect in a crime or anything like that. She just hands the clothes over to the detective in this case. So the detective takes the clothes and he brings them back to the police department. And when he does it according to what he describes as standard procedure. Now here, it's not clear that the standard procedure is written down anywhere, but there is apparently a standard procedure for investigators when they have clothes like this, but you know, bloody clothes that are evidence of a crime, clothes that have blood on them, to take them to the forensic floor of the police department, put them in a dry room, open them up, and go through them to make sure there's nothing in there that, you know, shouldn't be in there, no contraband or anything like that. And here, while the detective is going through the clothes to put them in the dry room, checking the pockets, he finds eudalone, which is a Schedule I controlled substance. And he, you know, ultimately then attributes the eudalone to the defendant. The defendant is files a motion to suppress, and the motion to suppress is denied, and so the defendant is convicted, and then the case goes up to the Court of Appeals. So you can kind of look at this case and say, well, all right, so, you know, how do I figure out if this is lawful or not? And I think this is a great opportunity to step back and say, when you're looking at a Fourth Amendment problem, oftentimes you need to ask a lot of different questions to get to the answer. And there's not going to be any one particular question that I can ask or one particular case. I'm going to say, oh, here's why it's lawful. Here's why it's not lawful. We got to step through and take the whole case apart to figure out what the problem really here is, and whether or not there is, you know, going to be whether or not it's going to be lawfully found or not lawfully found, right? So when we start out here in any kind of Fourth Amendment analysis or any Fourth Amendment situation, the first thing we ask is a basic question, which is there a Fourth Amendment problem here at all? In other words, is there a seizure or is there a search of a person, place, or thing, right, that would lead us to think that the Fourth Amendment is involved at all? And so, for example here, right, if there had never been a police search, then there's not a Fourth Amendment issue. And we're going to come back to this in a minute because this is actually a really important part of this case, right? And as a preview to it, think about this. How is it that the clothes come to be in the police's possession, right? Is there ever a search or a seizure by the police in this case? And so, you know, think back to what those facts are. We'll talk about that in a second. So that's the first question we want to ask, right? And then, you know, you want to ask yourself, all right, well, if there is a search or a seizure by police, if there was a search or a seizure, does the defendant have the right to challenge the search or the seizure? And we're going to come to that question as well. Because one of the questions in this case is, you know, when the officer enters the hospital room, is that a search or a seizure? Is that a lawful entry? Is the lawful officer there lawfully, right? And you can't, even if there is a search or a seizure, you don't necessarily get to challenge that, right? An officer might have searched a vehicle to find evidence, but if it's not your vehicle and you weren't in the vehicle and you didn't have control of the vehicle, then you have no right to challenge that search, even if it was a search that was contrary to the Fourth Amendment. So you don't get any further. Whether or not the search is lawful or not doesn't enter into it because you don't have a right to challenge it. And then if you do have the right to challenge it, then what is the level of evidence that's necessary, right? Does an officer have to have reasonable suspicion? Do they have to have probable cause? And what's the legal authority for what the officer did, right? So, you know, does the officer have a warrant? Does the officer have an exception to the warrant? And so on. So we'll kind of walk through that. So let's apply that in this case and see how the court did that here. So the first question we have to ask is the officer lawfully in the place that they are when they receive when the officer detective here receives the clothes? And here, the defendant is in the emergency room. So the defendant in this case, he appeals to a case called Morris versus Commonwealth, which is a Virginia Supreme Court case from 1967. And I think Morris is a really interesting case. In Morris, the defendant is shot, just like Mr. Meredith is. And here he's shot in an altercation near as they describe it in the case, a dance hall. That's the 1960s. And apparently he was shot by his own gun, is what it appears. The facts, it's not really clear, but he's shot by his own gun, which apparently went off in his pocket, supposedly. And he went to the hospital, and he was there for several days. When the detective arrives in the Morris case, he asks to get the defendant's clothes. The nurse goes and gets the clothes from the wardrobe room, the warden the wardrobe from the closet where the defendant had been assigned. At the time, the defendant was in a room. It was his room at the hospital. He was in the room alone. He was sedated and he was asleep. The nurse went in, took the clothes, and gave them to the detective. So in the Morris case, the defendant was in his own room, and he was paying for that room. He was being billed for that room as his hospital room. So let's start with that fact. In the Morris case, he has a private hospital room that was assigned to him. He was there for several days. He was paying for that room. So in the Morris case, what does that sound like to you? Right? That sounds like a hotel room. And we know from our Fourth Amendment understanding that a hotel room is a home, is like your home for purposes of the Fourth Amendment, which is to say it gets the same treatment as the home. The only way lawfully into someone's home is consent, a warrant of some kind, or exigent circumstances. And so the only way into a hotel room is consent, a warrant of some kind, or exigent circumstances. And Morris applies that rule to the hotel room and to the hospital room, the private hospital room, and says, oh, yeah, so the only way lawfully into Morris's private hospital room is either going to be consent, a warrant of some kind, or exigent circumstances. And finds in that case, because he's in a private hospital room, the officer did not lawfully enter that room and could not lawfully direct a nurse to enter on his behalf and collect those clothes. But that's a private hospital room. What about the case here where it's an emergency room, an ER? Well, there's a Virginia Court of Appeals case from 1999 called Matthews versus Commonwealth. And Matthews, who was an abduction suspect, was in a car crash and went to the emergency room. And he was in the emergency room when police arrived. They show up, they read him Miranda, and they get his clothes. Here, they get his clothes with his consent. They seize his clothing and his personal effects. But to step back for a second, Matthews, he had consented, but he steps back and says, well, hang on a second. Whether I consented or not, how did the officers get into that emergency room? They couldn't lawfully be in there. They had unlawfully entered, right? I can't get someone's consent by breaking into their house and then asking them for consent if I'm not lawfully in the house in the first place. And here, Matthews makes the same argument. He says the police violated his Fourth Amendment rights by entering his emergency room, treatment room, and therefore they couldn't be in there to ask him for consent or do anything because they weren't lawfully in there. So notice here, right, we're starting with the basic question, are the police in a place that they can lawfully be? Before we get to any exceptions to the warrant requirement, or do they have a warrant, or is there consent, or whatever, we got to first ask, are police lawfully in this place? And then by corollary, does the defendant have the right to challenge the police presence there? Does the defendant have standing to object? That's the question in the Matthews case. And here, the court says, well, this isn't like Morris, where he's in a private hotel, a hospital room. Here, he doesn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy because he's in an emergency ward treatment room, right? Morris was a case where he's getting long-term care. In Matthews, that's a place that's dedicated for emergency ward treatment. The door is open. People, family members are there. Medical personnel are there. People are walking in and out all over the place. It's not private from the emergency ward. It's part of the emergency ward. And therefore, you don't have an expectation of privacy. Anybody who's been to an ER, right? I mean, that immediately negates any possible expectation of privacy when you're in an ER, right? So what about here, right? What about in this case with Mr. Meredith in the city of Richmond in January? Well, here the court says, yeah, this is a situation where he's in the ER. He has no reasonable expectation of privacy. His treatment room is part of the ER. The door is wide open. Other people are present. There's no indication that anybody objected to the detective being there. He's got no privacy interest in that space. And so the detective is lawfully there in the room. Okay, so then the question becomes, all right, well, what about the clothes? The officer is lawfully there. He receives the clothes. Does Mr. Meredith have a privacy interest in his clothes? Well, it's interesting. There is a case called Spaulding versus Commonwealth. And Spaulding is a case, it's an unpublished case. It's from 2016. We actually talk about this in the Fourth Amendment search and seizure class, but that's a case where Spaulding is also shot. He's awake. He identifies himself. to the police. Again, he doesn't provide a lot of information about how it was that he came to be shot. But here, the officer goes ahead and searches the defendant's pants pocket and takes out his wallet and starts looking for ID and finds cocaine in the wallet. And there, again, the court's question is, what are you doing in the wallet, right? What right do you have to search his wallet? Mr. Spaulding provided his information to the officer. He said who he was. There was no reason to think he was not being truthful. There was no reason to be in his pockets. And so the court said that was an unlawful search. And the court emphasized here, Spaulding wasn't wearing the pants at the time. The pants had been cut off of him. They were layering somewhere else, but they were still his pants. And he still had a privacy interest in the contents of his pants, even though they had been cut off by medical personnel. But the court here says, well, let's compare this to another case, which is a 1980 case from the Virginia Supreme Court called Kraft versus Commonwealth. And that takes us back to an ER again, right? Because again, I think it's interesting, Spaulding is getting loaded into an ambulance. But here in Kraft, the defendant attempts to rob the owner of a convenience store and he gets shot during the attempted robbery. The owner gives a description of Mr. Kraft. He says he's wearing an old flowered shirt. The defendant again shows up to the hospital to receive treatment for his gunshot wounds, just like Mr. Meredith and so many other people in these cases. And while they're in the ER giving him care, medical personnel cut away his clothing, including the distinct floral patterned shirt, here containing two bullet holes. And they also cut a bullet out of his torso. The surgeon who operates on the defendant then asks the investigating officer, do you want to keep the clothes and do you want to keep the bullet as potential evidence of the crime? And here the officer said yes. And then they introduced the bullet and the clothing at trial. The defendant moved to suppress, but the trial court denied the motion. And the Virginia Supreme Court agreed, saying here, again, a person admitting themselves to an emergency room has very little expectation of privacy. And when you show up, you impliedly give consent to be given medical attention. So you're consenting to the clothes being cut off of you. That's not a search. The articles, the clothing, and the bullet come lawfully into possession of the medical personnel. And at that point, you don't have an expectation of privacy anymore in that bullet or in that clothing with respect to the medical personnel. Now, at this point, then, the medical personnel lawfully possess the clothing and the bullet. And because they lawfully possess it, they can turn it over to the police the same way as any private citizen can turn evidence over to the police. Notice that in the Kraft case, the 1980 case with the floral patterned shirt, just like in the Meredith case, the police don't ask for the evidence. They don't walk in and say, hey, give me all of Kraft's clothing or give me all of Meredith's clothing. Instead, the medical personnel offer it to the police. And so we're back in a situation of that sort of basic question. Is there a search or a seizure here by the police? They're lawfully in the place they are. It's an ER. So basically, you have no expectation of privacy. They can lawfully be in the ER. When they receive the clothing, that's not a search either or a seizure by police because they're being offered it by the medical personnel. It's not, therefore, even involved. The Fourth Amendment doesn't even get involved because we're not asking, is it a search or a seizure? However, there's an important difference. In the Kraft case, the clothing itself is the evidence. In other words, the bullet holes and the bullet are the evidence, right? The clothing has a hole in it. The bullet is a bullet, right, itself from the victim of the robbery. So the question here is the clothing itself lawfully obtained by the police? Is the bullet lawfully obtained by the police? But Meredith is a little bit different, right? Because in Meredith, like in the Spaulding case where the officer, the guy who's awake in the ambulance, the officer's searching through his wallet, in the Meredith case from Richmond from January and the Spaulding case where the guy is shot and the officer goes through his wallet, the officers lawfully got the clothing, but now they're going through the pockets. They're searching the pockets. That is a search, right? And so now we have to ask, the police are lawfully standing in the place they're lawfully standing, the ER. They lawfully have the clothes because it wasn't a search. It was given to them by the nurses. But how do they lawfully have the authority to search it? And in Spaulding, right, the officer lawfully has the Mr. Spaulding's pants. Mr. Spaulding has been shot. He's being lauded in the ambulance. The pants are right there. But he's searching the pants. And in Meredith, the case from January that just happened in Richmond, the officer is searching the pants. So that does look like a search, right? And so for that, there has to be some kind of lawful authority for officers to conduct the search. The seizure is lawful, perfectly appropriate, not even implicates the Fourth Amendment at all, but the search has to have some Fourth Amendment reason, right? And remember, in Kraft, where the guy's shot and he's in the ER, he was shot by the guy he was robbing, the search of Mr. Kraft's body is done by the medical personnel, right? And what they have at that point then is seizable evidence. It's clearly evidence of the crime. But in Meredith, we don't know this is evidence of a crime yet because Meredith won't tell us anything. So that leaves us the question, are we lawfully going through the pockets of these pants that we have lawfully come into possession of? And so we ask first, do we have a warrant to do that? Well, no, there's no warrant. Do we have consent to do that? Well, no, we have no consent. So there has to be some exception to the warrant requirement that allows us to search the pockets. And remember here, as the Court of Appeals told us in the published case from the summer, Parody, the mere fact that you have probable cause alone doesn't permit you to search something. And so here, even if the officer had probable cause to search the pants, it wouldn't be enough to search them. You have to have probable cause plus a warrant, or probable cause plus some exception to the warrant requirement. So the court says, all right, what's the lawful exception to the warrant requirement in this case that allows the officer to search Mr. Meredith's pants, the guy from January in the city of Richmond? Well, here the court says, well, and I think most of you are screaming at your, you know, radios or phones or, you know, while you're running or whatever you're listening to this. What about an inventory search, right? And that's what the court looks at here, an inventory search. And it's interesting because the way the court applies the inventory search exception, the court here applies it sort of conflating the inventory search exception and the community caretaker exception. And I don't think that's wrong in this case, but I think it's interesting that the court did it. And the court did it by looking at a Fifth Circuit case called U.S. versus Gravett from 1973, which I think was a really strange way of coming at this problem. You know, the Fifth Circuit is not our circuit. The Fifth Circuit has a lot of really crazy, zany rulings that really don't apply here. But I think the reason the court did it was they wanted to bring together the idea of the inventory search and the community caretaker search into one doctrine here. So the court looks at a case called U.S. versus Gravett, which is from 1973 in the Fifth Circuit. And Gravett explains that when the police take custody of any kind of container, whether it's an automobile, a suitcase, or anything that property can be stored in, it's reasonable to search the container to itemize the property to be held by the police. And the court in the Gravett case called it an inventory search, right? Inventorying it to preserve the property of the individual and to forestall the possibility that the individual may later claim that the item hasn't been returned to them. So in Virginia, right, we talk about the inventory search exception in a couple of different situations. One would be where somebody's been arrested for DUI or something and the code requires us to tow that vehicle. Then we would do an inventory search of that vehicle, right? So in Williams versus Commonwealth, for example, which is a case from 2004, the court describes the inventory search exception. But in Williams, the court is describing it not in a situation where the defendant's being arrested, but they're describing it in more of a situation of a community caretaker, right? And so in Williams, the vehicle is being towed because the defendant has a suspended license, and so the vehicle is going to get towed away. But the court looks at it as a community caretaker type of search because the vehicle has no evidentiary value. We're not searching it for evidence. We're searching it basically to protect it because Williams is going to go to jail. We can't just leave the car there on the side of the road. So the court talks about the inventory search as being a type of community caretaker search, right? And explains that under the community caretaker exception, police can conduct warrantless inventory searches of vehicles, provided that the vehicle was lawfully impounded, the impoundment and subsequent search are conducted pursuant to standard procedures, and the impoundment and subsequent search are not a pretext or a surrogate for an improper investigatory motive. And that's important because we've talked a couple times this last couple of years about cases where officers had lawful authority to conduct an inventory search of a vehicle, but the officers used it as an opportunity instead to look for evidence, to do an investigation. And when the courts saw body camera footage and in-dash camera footage that demonstrated that the officers were really only looking for evidence, the court said, well, that's you using an inventory search as a pretext to do an investigative search, and therefore we're going to suppress the evidence. And that's a real thing that happens. It's happened several times in the last few years in the Court of Appeals. You really want to watch out for it. Stay within the bounds of the inventory search exception if you're doing an inventory search of a vehicle. Do an actual inventory search. If you find contraband, fine, but keep doing your inventory search. Don't give up because we can get in trouble if we stop doing an inventory search and turn it into an investigative search. So here, right, the court, I think, is looking to the Gravett case because the Gravett case applies the inventory search exception and those rules to any kind of search of a container. And the court here says that, again, if we're searching a container like a backpack or a bag or here a pair of pants, the policy considerations are the same, right? We're trying to protect the owner's property while it's in police custody. We're trying to protect the police against claims or disputes concerning lost or stolen property. And oh, by the way, we're also trying to protect the police and public from physical danger, right? We don't want to, for example, bring a pair of pants into our drying room in the forensic unit that's got a bunch of fentanyl in it, because that's it, right? Now we have to shut down the entire forensic unit because we brought fentanyl in. That would be terrible, right? So because we have those three considerations, we're permitted to search not just vehicles, but any kind of property, any kind of container that's coming into police custody, even if it's not for an investigation. And in this case, in the Meredith case, our case from Richmond from January, the detective here, the court says, applying these requirements from the Williams case, from the Gravett case, they say, look, is the clothing lawfully in police custody? Yes. They didn't conduct any kind of search. They were lawfully in the ER because the defendant has no right to be there. They received the clothes from the medical personnel. It's not conducted as part of a search. It's just given to them. So they're lawfully holding the clothing. It's in our custody. Now, was the search conducted pursuant to standard police procedures? Yes. The detective explains what the procedures are. We have standard procedures for how we handle it. This is how we handle clothing in every case. We didn't just make up a rule for this case. And so notice that's important, right? If you're going to do this, you want to have standard procedures. And three, the court says, there's no evidence that it's a pretextual surrogate for an improper investigatory motive, right? Here, he's following procedures. He's just trying to make sure there's nothing in there. There's no evidence here that he's looking for evidence or something. And again, what would be evidence of? We don't know because he won't tell us anything anyway. So here the court says, under the inventory exception, the search conducted was reasonable. And I think it's interesting because here the court talks about it sort of in both the phrases community caretaker and inventory. They kind of use those words interchangeably. And that's something I try not to do, but I can see the court doing it. So the court says that the officer therefore lawfully found the drugs, and therefore the trial court properly denied the motion to suppress because he didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the emergency ward. The police lawfully came into possession of his clothing, and the search of his clothing was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment as an inventory search or community caretaker search of those pockets. And although this case is something that you may not run into on all occasions, I think it's a great example of how to think through your problems. Right? Am I standing somewhere I'm lawfully permitted to be? Is there a lawful Fourth Amendment reason for me to be in the place that I am? Do I have a warrant? Is there an exception to the warrant requirement? Do I have consent? Why am I lawfully here? Okay, if I'm lawfully in the place I am I lawfully allowed to be seizing the person or the thing that I'm seizing? Again, do I have a warrant? Do I have consent? Do I have an exception of some kind? And then does the defendant have a right to object to my being here at all or to seizing this thing? And then lastly, if I'm going to seize, if I've lawfully come into possession of this person or thing, can I lawfully search it for the kind of search that I'm doing? Am I doing a pat-down search? Am I doing a full search of the thing, the car, the bag, the person? Am I just patting down the bag or patting down the car? Am I patting down the person, or am I doing a full search? And if so, what's legally required for me to do that? And do I have that legal requirement met? Right? If it's a pat down, do I have reasonable suspicion? If it's a full search, do I have a warrant? Do I have consent? Do I have an exception to the warrant requirement? I hope that this was helpful. I hope that today was helpful. It's a little different way of approaching a case, but I think it's important for us to think about how to think. And so I hope today would be helpful to help you see how to think or think how to think. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. We're on SoundCloud. We're on Stitcher Podcast. We're on a bunch of different podcast apps. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell your friends. But for today, that's all from me. That's all from Big E. Stay safe and don't get captured.